Up next on JusticeFound.org, Roland Washington and David Kordsmeyer interview Melba Maldonado, Executive Director of the La Raza Community Resource Center, located in the Mission District of San Francisco. Today in the Worker Justice Talk, we discuss with Melba her outlook on activism and the importance of revolution as it shaped her approach to fighting for rights and fighting for equal opportunities and fighting to crush racism. And we get into how important it is today to continue to fight for these things, fighting for equal opportunities, equal housing, and equal access to healthcare. This is David Kordsmeyer from the Justice Foundation, and I'm excited to bring you another edition of the Worker Justice Talk with the host, Roland Washington.
This is Roland Washington for JusticeFound.org and a community worker on KPOO San Francisco. Today I'm going to interview Melba Maldonado, Executive Director of La Raza Community Resource Center. And along with me conducting this interview is David Kordsmeyer from the Justice Foundation. Melba, how are you today?
Oh, I'm good. And, you know, thank you for coming over to the mission to have this interview.
Your name came up on several occasions in regards to organizing in the mission. I was told if there was something happening, especially trying to help the people, that your fingers were in it. If not your fingers, you were totally in it, from the immigration movement to five to six minimum organizations that you were linked to, including something with the police department in Jordan's administration.
Well, not with the police department.
Yeah, they said you sat on like a committee or something for the mayor or something like that.
Right, but that was a committee it was a federal grant to provide funds to community organizations so they can do activities and efforts to stem the scourge of drug abuse in our communities. And that was a program under AGNOS. Mayor Agnos, and it started under Mayor Agnos, and of course it continued, and it ended on the term of Mayor Jordan. But it wasn't a Jordan program, it wasn't an Agnos program, it was a federal program that was fought by actually people like your mentor, Scotty, our Japanese-American friend in Japantown, Jeff Murray, Bob Hernandez, and other people who had always been involved in bringing community resources to help, stem the tide of poverty, racism, and drug abuse, and, you know, this type of what I call genocide in our communities.
Mm. One of the questions I ask people from the mission is, I don't know if they want to call it gentrification. Back in the day, they called it, I think it was Justin Herman called it, instead of urban renewal, called it Negro removal. And it looks like in the mission district, it's Latino removal. The district, the neighborhood does not look the way it used to look all the time. I'm born and raised in San Francisco, and it's just very drastic the way things have changed. I mean, is it that type of thing going on, or am I just hallucinating?
No. It's still going on, and I think in the Mission District we are lucky to have a group of younger generation activists who are really working very, very hard in dealing with this problem in this century. Of course. In the 60s, in the 70s, it wasn't just only in San Francisco where it was the poor people's removal, but also it was all over the United States. You know, it was happening in Newark, New Jersey. That's where I came to leave from Puerto Rico to Newark, New Jersey. And that was part of my own political involvement in the community with Puerto Ricans and African Americans in Newark, New Jersey in the 1960s. So what was happening in San Francisco, later on, it's, you know, it was part of the general plan in this country on what to do with us.
And mm-hmm. in my understanding, in Newark back then, was Newark was like the best place to be, at least if you're white, had the best income, best homes, and on, and they had this area where the blacks lived that blew up in, what, 64 or something like that, but the whites lived this incredible lifestyle compared to other parts of America.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and it was just the same as it would be in Philly or in other cities in the eastern, you know, in the east side of the United States. Not only that, you know, I mean, it was Newark was a city, or is, you know, was a city that was the majority black and Puerto Rican, because now we say Latinos because, you know, over here, mm-hmm. but over there it was obviously a mm-hmm. Puerto Rican community. And in the 60s, I would say that it was maybe 15% white. And mm-hmm. they run City Hall, the police, and the fire department, and every speck of power. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the black riots in Newark, and then soon after that, a few years after that, the Puerto Rican riots, that change came. And change came because we worked together. You know, we got together. We had a black and Puerto Rican convention in Newark, and but these are lessons that you learn. Unfortunately, we selected candidates who didn't provide and didn't really made the reforms or the at least the peaceful revolution that we wanted to, you know, because look at Newark today. They still have the very basic issues of violence and poverty and racism and, you know, where is the advancement? So, you know, hey, this is maybe a conversation that we can have another time. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, here in San Francisco, for the past 5 years, you have a movement in the Mission. And I suggest, I don't know if you've had anybody from MAC, the Mission Anti-Displacement Coalition. I totally support it. I am not, you know, I don't attend too much of the meetings, but, you know, of course, we all support it. And are 100% behind their efforts to make sure that the few Latino families that are still in the Mission are not displaced.
How did the Mission District come to be? I mean, I grew up in the Western Addition. I know for us, I guess, that was a cheaper place for blacks to live. I think it was called South Park. A lot of blacks lived in South Park, too. And I know folks came up from the South. How did the Mission become the place? Was that just an identified area for the Latino community based on red, whatever, you know what we're calling it, discrimination, housing discrimination? Or?
Yes, well, I can tell you what I've heard, and I'm from reading and researching a little bit of historical facts. Personally, I came to the Mission District in 1977. So there had been, you know, like a whole lot of struggle before I came. But the Mission District was originally a district of, or it has historically been a district of immigrants. Originally, this district was Irish and poor Italians and poor Irish. Actually, you see, like, for example, you see the Cap Street Center, Mission Neighborhood Center, is on 362 Cap Street. It used to be a home for what they used to call wayward girls way back in the early 1900s. So this has been the area where the immigrants came, and the big you know, those white immigrants were able to, of course, make it, or you know, a move outside or move maybe to a better area, see, within San Francisco, and then the Mexican American community started coming in, and they were the original people who were here. Were, so of course they were here, but I'm talking about, you know, the new immigrants were coming to who would stay in these areas, and coming from the valley, they were moving into the city. So, but you know, that was it's all a dynamic that is not new to San Francisco. It's just, you know, all around, any place in the United States, it's happened that way, where people move, you know, are constantly on the move, and everybody looks for a better situation.
So when you came to San Francisco in the 70s, what was the first group you started getting involved with when it comes to the social justice stuff?
Well, when I came here, I already had my contacts with the people who were doing Puerto Rico solidarity work. The, you know, independence for Puerto Rico has been, you know, an ideal of mine, and you know, many of my contemporaries. And when I came here, I came with a mission. You know, I was sent to organize amongst the Puerto Ricans and amongst the Americans and the rest. You know, the United States people here, the Americans, to support Puerto Rican independence. Our movement was very, very, very strong in Puerto Rico and internationally. So we had offices in the East Coast, in Chicago and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Oakland. So that's why I came. And also, I met my first husband here, you know, who's from San Francisco, and so I stayed.
Can you elaborate about Puerto Rico's situation?
Well, it is a commonwealth.
Commonwealth.
A commonwealth, and Puerto Rico has to obey and has the federal laws of the United States rule in Puerto Rico. And this is a state. It's like a state, which is called a free associated state. You know, so it's a combination, because when we think Commonwealth, we think of Canada. You know, but no, it's not that way. It's called a free associated state, where the state has its own constitution, Puerto Rican constitution. For example, in our constitution, the death penalty doesn't exist. You know, there is no death penalty in Puerto Rico, but there is, you know, in terms of the United States. So so the laws are, the federal laws rule Puerto Rico, and we are citizens from birth. Even if you're born in Puerto Rico, you're a citizen of the United States. And
but you don't have a senator or anything like that, right?
No, we don't.
There's no representation in Washington. There is a
representative, but he doesn't have voice. He only has voice. He doesn't have a vote. And you know, it's a militarized island. It's, you know, that was the main issue for the past 50 years. The, you know, Puerto Rico was, you know, it was like a weapon. You know, I mean, it was totally militarized. And as you know, I know many of your listeners have heard about the struggle of Vieques, the island that, you know, finally after 40, 50, 60 years of struggle, finally were able to get rid of the Navy. And now, what are the main issues? Well, the cleanup. The cleanup of the nuclear dump that they have left. So that's what's you know, the issue right now. And of course, the issue of independence has always been a, you know, a the status and the political status has always been, a discussion on Puerto Ricans, and you vote. You can vote for to become a state, or you can vote for the governor of Puerto Rico. But in terms of having a referendum of, do you want to be an independent nation or do you want to be a state of the United States, that has never come to a vote, to a clear vote in, with the people of Puerto Rico.
Do Puerto Ricans get to vote for president?
No.
Okay. And recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, didn't some kind of referendum go to ballot regarding
the status?
Statehood or some? I recall something recently.
Well, yeah, there has been many referendums, and in each time there is always a block of people who refuse to accept that referendum because it's like this false referendums because it's they don't let you choose between two. It's always, do you want to stay as you are? And we have a saying, barriga llena, corazón contento. A full belly is a happy heart, and a lot of people say, well, I don't, I want to stay as it is. So it's always a question of continuing organizing and making sure that that people understand that, there is so much to gain when you are independent. There is so much to gain. It's not just about being a society that is full of things, of, comfort, but, your mental and your, psychological makeup can really turn around and change when you are a whole person. And, at least that's my belief, because I truly believe in what Franz Fanon taught, that when you're colonized, you cannot make the decisions. You really need to be free in order to make the changes that need to be made.
In comparison to now, I know probably in hindsight, it probably looks like the 60s and the 70s were like these halcyon days and people were coming together and stuff. But the oppression is still oppression. And if there's a we instead of the I, then communities come together. Do you think that are people still organizing to the same levels?
Oh, I think there are many things happening. There are, efforts all over the place. The difference is what is done by an organized entity or what is done in terms of issues. So I think today people are organizing around issues. And the beauty would be how can, they're to find the threads that unite these issues and what can be of benefit for everybody's struggle. So that's, and for that you need people who are going to, who are really invested in sharing their knowledge, in sharing their resources, because it boils down to resources and what is affecting people personally at that moment. But we always believed, at least in the way we learned, that people get organized in what really affects them first. And the important thing is to make the leap into, okay, so now my issue is resolved. How can I help someone else? Or what is the next issue on the agenda? And that's the only way that you really can organize into a big mass movement. And that's the way. And also give value to everybody. We in this country, so many places tend to be, dazzled by personalities. I mean, and you can see it even in the trash media every day that, you know, there is, you know, people are dazzled by personalities. So there is sometimes community movements mirror that, you know. It's like nothing gets done until you get the nod or the go-ahead from so-and-so. You know, later for that, you know, when you have a need, you really need to speak up and find other people who are, you know, who are supportive of what you're saying and go from there. Really trust your intuition because, and you value yourself because everybody is of tremendous value. I don't believe that anybody can be made into, you know, a leader without having people next to him or her. I mean, just before we started the interview, we were talking a little bit about Che Guevara. It's his anniversary of his death today. And now, would Che be well known if he, you know, if he had just acted on his own all the time and not be part of a larger movement, you know. So those are the things that I, you know, like, that I think about when I see. And also, don't be afraid to ask other people opinions and, you know, go outside of your immediate box and go somewhere else to find support for your ideas.
So when you started in the 60s and 70s, getting politicized and getting involved, you were fighting for equality and fighting against racism. And what are you fighting for now? The same thing?
Well,
have we made progress?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a different type of fight. One of the things that that we know is that things don't change, and there are issues that are so they're compelling issues that don't change. For example, housing has always been an issue. Access to services has always been an issue. Schools has always been an issue. You know, the school, the education of our children. I mean, that was absolutely one of my first involvements when I came to this country in, you know, 1966. I mean, school systems that were not serving the people and the children. I mean, this is 2006, and we're still having the same problems. Why? Because the institutions haven't changed. And if you don't change the institution, and if you think that you're going to change the institution by putting a Latino person there or a black person there, I mean, that helps because our children need to see us, you know, in a different or an Asian person. They need to see us at different levels of, of a normal world. To be part of the normal world. But it's not just the color of the skin, it's also what that person intends to do and what are the connections between that person and what needs to be done. The issues are that the schools have bad curriculum and they don't have the right curriculums. And they also have a lot of bad teachers who are there forever. And also because sometimes, you know, most of the times our communities are not there involved with the children's, in their children's education, you know. And we complain about it. But we don't go there, we don't go to the PTA meetings, and we don't make sure that we turn off that television between 6 and 8 o'clock, and we tell our children, this is your time to think about what you did at school today. Let me see your books and go and read for a little while. There is no TV. You know, I mean, as simple as that. So what I'm saying is that there is a combination of things that make it that the problem is still here. And but we have more resources to them amongst ourselves. So it's not like there are no resources. You see what I'm saying? Before, in the 70s, we had nothing. We had not a black or Puerto Rican or a Latino or Asian face anywhere. And now we do. So now I think that it's time for especially the younger people coming up to look at this, to study history, to study and to figure out what is the, you know, maybe a different way to approach it.
Is part of the problem? I mean, when you talk, just even referring to this idea of having your kids actually read a book or do something besides watch TV, part of the problem is how we're living, maybe? Because we as, say, parents or adults, we're the ones watching TV and setting the wrong example for the kids. I mean, has society kind of corrupted us in a way that it makes us hard to do the right, makes it hard for us to do the right thing, even with the resources we have?
Yeah, maybe, but not on you know, not on everybody, because I don't want to sound pessimistic. You know, I think that we have gained a lot, but we also have to make sure that this is not the end. You know, this is it. That we have arrived, as they say in the United States, because it's not true. It's not true at all, and it's part of the consumerism and teaching the children, you know, that, you know, there is a better way to live. There's a simpler way, because right now there is something coming, you know, some other issues coming up that we were not working on in the 60s and 70s, the environment. I mean, for the past 30 years, 20 years, this has been a, you know, a real concern and true, and that is a major concern about the environment, and you know, that has to be part of anything that we do in terms of changing the institutions and making sure that they used to laugh when we used to talk about the military-industrial complex. But it's true. It's totally true. I mean, these are the people who are, you know, the corporations are running this country, has always run this country, and they have, you know, ruined the world. So, you know, how do you deal with that? We used to also, in the 70s, we used to talk to, at least I did, because I was always involved with the solidarity movement, talking to Americans, talking to people from Latin America and from different parts of the world about what was going on, you know, internationally in terms of repression. Now, it was the attitude of the movement in the United States the police are not just going to come in and take you. This only happens in Central America. This only happens in the Caribbean or some dictatorship out there. And we were complaining, at least the blacks and Puerto Ricans, way in the 70s, about how we felt that the FBI was looking into our mail, that they were... And they were doing, you know, sending saboteurs to our organizations and doing damage to the movement. Now, some people thought we were paranoid, and other people, you know, didn't believe that was happening. Now, we know now for the fact that it did happen. It destroyed people. It killed people. And it's now sanctioned at the highest spheres of the United States government, starting at the president's desk, when he says it's okay to tape phones, it's okay to take people out of this country and take them anywhere to a secret prison, and it's totally okay because we're fighting terrorism. Now, when I was younger and I was very active in the international movement for liberation, it was that You had to be watched and you had to be curtailed because of the Soviet threat of the, you know, in the world. So it's just the enemy changes. Hmm.
So you talked about arriving and that we haven't arrived yet. How will we know when we've arrived?
Well, you know, it's a very hard question. It's when when people, you know, there is always going to be struggle. There is going to be, but when the basic needs of a person, of a family, are met, in terms of there is a job, there is possibilities of choices, either that you can get a higher education, that you can go get a job, that you can go get a training, and that is not something that you had to fight for it. You know, it's just like when it's a given. When you have a society where those issues are given to a sector of the society, like rich people in this country, they don't worry about these things. It's just a given that their children are going to go to school, or that they're going to, you know, have a business, or, you know, when that is a given, you know. So I want the same thing for our people and for all oppressed people in this country, that we have the opportunities and also that we have a say in that we don't want to invade other countries. When you can say to your government, this is what I want, and the government agrees and says, yes, that's the way it should be, then we've arrived. But, you know, I mean, that's kind of utopian. But, you know,
it's worth fighting for, right?
Yes.
The La Raza Community Resource Center. What is this? In case people were hearing sounds in the background, that's because we're at the La Raza Community Resource Center that has children and all kind of people here. So those are the sounds you have in the, you're hearing in the background. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is an agency that is, you know, it's a non-profit agency. It has been in the Mission District in San Francisco for, since 1974. It was founded very interestingly. This group of agencies, because we are part of a group of agencies, were founded with the idea that the community, the Latino community, needed services who addressed, you know, the people's needs, but also with a political and a conscious consciousness about involvement, about advocating, and about making changes in society. But this was through the nonprofits. Remember, in the 60s, a lot of organizations cropped up because of the model cities. So the government gave money to organizations to be founded. So each poor community had a major one or two organizations. So this one, La Raza Community Resource Center, was originally called La Raza Information Center. And it was part of a asset building movement that has really had fantastic people at its own. You know, they were young people. They were young people who were at a state or at law school at that time. They were young people who thought that the regular nonprofit agencies were tools of City Hall. So this started, and personally, I wasn't here. I inherited, you know, the work of the agency and the vision of the agency. But they're wonderful set of people who started this movement. And maybe one time that you can, I'll give you their names to make sure that I don't leave anybody out, because I don't want to say names right now. And they founded what is called La Raza en Acción Local. La Raza en Local Action. Quickly, a translation. And the idea was, of course, you know, have lawyers to help people stop evictions and help them out with issues. Have people involved in housing to help people find apartments and build apartment houses for, you know, that were geared to help low-income people. Have an information referral center which would, you know, guide people who came in. They were told where to go for services and what to do, and do not let anybody step over you, and, you know, just kind of organize people into action. That was the ideal. And also we had an arm that was the students or the young people who were artists. And this was the arts, what is still called La Raza Graphics. That started here on 24th Street. Originally, this is where we were. And La Raza Centro Legal was part of it. And, you know, the later on, as the years went by, each wing or each, how you call it, department sector that was serving each sector of the community, then everybody got their own nonprofit status and had became different organizations. So this is why today you have to make, you know, lots of La Raza. So we are La Raza Resource Center, and we provide services for families. We have a food pantry. We have counseling, case management. We find apartments. We provide services, family support services. We also provide immigration services. We provide what we call community education, which are workshops and informationals on whatever issue is affecting the community. And of course, immigration laws have been one of the issues, so we've done quite a bit of that. At the same time, we also, as an agency, have ties and collaborations with other agencies serving doing family support. We are concerned also for the families who are involved with child protective services. So we are always working with these families and working with the department to make sure that the families get reunified and the families thrive. We also have made collaborations with other organizations that are in the immigrant rights movement, and, you know, and we also not just support and advocate for better laws and for fair laws in immigration to our people, but also we provide services so people can get their status, you know, the legal status in this country. We teach citizenship and we fill out forms. And we also have collaborations with parents and agencies in Bayview, Hunters Point, and other citywide organizations in making sure that our agenda in terms of family services, it's a common agenda to help all our families.
La Raza came together, it sounds like, as a collective, as a coalition. Is there ways that we can see that starting now with young people? Are there ways that this can be implemented to bring all the youth together, youth of color?
Well, I think there's great possibilities, and, you know, and here in the Mission, there are quite a few really good groups that are doing really good work in the community, and you know, probably you can start, you know, in with working with them, or, you know, getting to know them, or, you know, whatever comes in terms of getting the youth together. You know, there is Poder, that's people organized to demand environmental rights. And their house right here in Centro del Pueblo, in this building down the hall, they do excellent work with young people in trainings and also, you know, getting young people involved in environmental issues. But also, you know, an environment is just includes everything. You know, where you live, your access to services, your access, how young people get treated, what is the issues with the parks, with our parks, with the schools, and they are involving all those issues. So I would suggest that, you know, you invite one, you know, a couple of the young people that work with Poder to come and talk about it and maybe begin a dialogue about what is common and what is the common thread that can unite the youth.
In closing, is there something you want to say?
Well, thank you very much, guys. You know, it's hard to have an interview early in the morning and you don't know where you're going to be asked. So all this has been impromptu, you know, and hopefully, you know, this is food for thought for, you know, further discussion. I mean, there is just so much that we didn't touch. There is so much we didn't touch about, you know, how communities get revitalized, what affect the communities in terms of, for example, you take, which my husband was involved in this, you take the student strike at a state university. For some maybe thought that it was just an isolated student incident. It was never that. Those students, along with the support that they had from the community, started the whole movement of Black students organizations and Black studies in the whole of the United States. That's amazing. So the example is, do not think that what you do is just going to be forgotten or that it has no value. Anything you do in a group, in a collective setting, that is truly for the to benefit more or the other than yourself, that can have repercussions. And people don't forget it.